Yeah, I came for giving a lecture here, but first of all, I have to ask you to forgive us for being late. Sorry. It's a good thing the lecture is not on punctuality. It's on mantra meditation, specifically with the idea of stress relief. Is it? I was told that? Yeah. Okay. Oh, we just had a bit of a stressful drive there. Mantra. First of all, we should know what mantra means. Man means mind. Sanskrit. And in most Indian languages also. In Telugu also. Or you're from all over India, presumably. In Telugu, it's also manam, something like that. Manasu. Should be an u at the end. In Telugu. And tra means triate, that which delivers. That which delivers or uplifts the mind. So, that's interesting for all of you, isn't it? Because you're all working with your mind. In the computer field, everyone's working with their mind. And actually, everyone is. Even the street sweeper also works with his mind. Yeah, the mind has to be applied. Mind and body. You also use your body. If you get carpal tunnel syndrome, then it becomes more difficult to do your job. So mind and body are required, but specifically, you're being employed for your ability to use your mind in, or intelligence, we can say. Mind and intelligence are intimately interlinked. So, it requires a certain kind of intelligence to, presumably, you're mostly software engineers, is it? To see the problem, what is required, and write the program in the most efficient way, and then get all the bugs out. So this is the function of the mind that you're being employed for, but the mind has other functions also. Other things happen. There are side effects. Apart from the mind functioning to perceive a task that is required and find out the best way to do it, there are other factors also, which in traditional Hinduism, we could say, for want of a better word, these are known as kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsarya. Desire, here desire means not good desires, lust, anger, greed, envy, the illusion and the madness of identifying oneself with the body. Now, in modern psychology or even just day-to-day workplace talk, we hear other factors that impact on the mind. Stress, as us especially to speak about stress relief. Stress, depression, schizophrenia, these are common words which previously, before the days of IT, not just IT, but the whole modern life, these were not common words. Stress was there, but not in the psychological context. So these are factors of modern life. Stress, depression especially, and then more intense schizophrenia. What's that medicine in America? Everyone knows for depression. It's such a common medicine. Everyone knows the name. I forgot. You forgot too. It's a household word in America. Just like you say, everyone in India knows what a jalebi is. So there's some medicine in America. When I was in America, I was hearing it all the time, but I forgot now. People commonly say that, oh, I'm on such and such medication, but I forgot the name. Everyone knows. It's such a common thing. Medication for depression. So, how does this happen? How does it come about? If there's a problem, to solve it, we have to find the best way to solve a problem is to find out the cause and treat the cause. That's the difference between, or a basic difference between, traditional medicines, of which in India Ayurveda is famous, and modern medicines, which tend to give symptomatic treatment. Just like aspirin, it just covers up the headache. It doesn't cure the cause, or Amritamjan, you rub it on and it makes a sensation which is stronger than the headache sensation. And it's a little bit better than the headache sensation. It's not very nice. And it doesn't cure anything, but it makes it feel a little bit better. So that's entered the English language. The metaphorically, we say it's an anodynic solution. If it's not really a solution, it's just something to make you feel better, although the problem is still there. So what is the root cause of stress? Well, that's not very difficult. It would seem not very difficult to say that you've got so much pressure, more work to handle and more things to do, more responsibilities than you can handle over a long period of time. Over a protracted period of time, the pressure builds up and one feels stress. On the other hand, if there's no stress, then you wouldn't be, there's no motive to work. Some stress is good also. If they say, here's a project, when should it be finished? Well, anytime. You never heard that, did you? It's always less time than you think it's humanly possible to do it in. And that's, the stress is there, that gets the adrenaline going and the brain thinking. If there's no pressure, then you can't actually think properly anyway. So some pressure is required. If it's just, you know, whenever you like, it doesn't matter, then you don't take it seriously. So some stress is required, but there becomes a cracking point. And I heard that in Bangalore, the mental institutions are doing a good business. It's one of the, there's the IT business, is a good business, and the mental institutions for IT professionals who snap. They're also, all the mental hospitals are full of IT professionals or ex-IT professionals because sometimes it gets too much. And apart from the mental factors, there are also other physical factors, just like, odd hours. The human body is not, I might get thrown out for saying all these things, but actually it's a fact. That the human body is not meant for staying up all night, maybe on occasion, but regularly the body clock doesn't work properly if you stay up at night and sleep in the day. It just doesn't work. It works for Ravana and company. They're called Nishacha. In Ramayana, Ravana and the Rakshasas, they're all called Nishacha. Nishacha means those who move around at night. But human being doesn't. So by the arrangement, by another arrangement of nature, America works on a different time scale to India. So it's a factor of many workers in India today that they're up at night while the Americans are working in the day. Maybe if America's if India's economy improves more, there'll come a time when the Americans are outsourcing and they have to stay up at night. But at the present time, the Indians have to stay up at night. So that's one factor. And then irregular eating habits. So all these impact on the mind. There are social factors also which cause a lot of stress, because apart from doing the job, and it's not just a matter of what job you get, but there's what prestige is attached with it. That's very important in modern Indian life. People are very much attached to prestige. So it's not only that you work for such and such a company, but you have to show it also. People are very much, in modern India, people are very much concerned with external appearances, which wasn't there a generation ago. On the street, you couldn't tell who was a rich man and who wasn't, because, well, you could tell because they'd have the rich Marwaris, or they'd have this dhoti and kurta, same as everyone else, but they'd have gold. What do they call those? Buttons. What's it called?
Buttons.
Yeah, but it's on a chain, so like that. They wouldn't show off their wealth, but nowadays you have to show it off, and then you have to wear all have to have a watch commensurate with your position, and you have to go on holiday to Singapore, otherwise you're not really up there. Maybe Goa, but Singapore, or go on holidays, go around the world. You have to show it off. And keeping up with all of this can be tough. I mean, you all look a little older, but for the young, those who are just out of college, they're very much concerned with all this, showing off how, what kind of clothes they wear, and what kind of, how much money they can spend and throw away. So there are social factors also. One has to, practically all these come, there are so many companies like Nike and Rolex and Levi's. They do business just on their name because it's prestigious to use the products of these companies. And that's with cars also, that if you drive a Mercedes car, then BMW, that's highly prestigious. You don't get so much in India, but not yet. But in the West, people say, Mercedes car, that means prestigious. So keeping up with all this prestige, that these social factors, it also produces stress, because you're expected to perform and show that you're better than others. All this contributes to stress. So mantra is for delivering the mind. And the Vedic literature is mostly composed in mantras. Now there are different kinds of mantras. The mantra that our movement is famous for is the Hare Krishna mantra, which is known as the Maha Mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now there are many other mantras. All the verses of Gita and Bhagavatam, they're also mantras. And just by chanting them, or just by hearing them chanted, even if we don't know the meaning, you can experience this. It's very soothing to the mind. Just recently, not last time, the time before, I was in Chennai, and it's a common thing. We visited one temple in the evening, and there were a group of people who, they come in the evening, every evening they assemble, and they chant together verses from Gita and Vishnu Sahasranam. And even if you don't understand what it means, just hearing it, it's very soothing to the mind. And if you do hear it and what it means, that's even more soothing, because it's not just the chanting, it's not just the psychic effect of the chanting, but the knowledge that is given, that gives relief also. Why are we suffering? Stress is a kind of suffering, isn't it? All this, kam, krodh, lobh, that gives rise to suffering. Desire, this in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains that desire, this is the great mistake of the whole material world, and especially in the modern materialistic society. The idea that fulfillment of desire leads to happiness. But in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna describes that fulfillment of material desire, first of all, is never fully fulfilled anyway. And even if it is fulfilled, it simply produces more frustration. That's why kam, next is krodh. Desire is followed by anger. Krodh. Another name for krodh is kamanuja, which means which comes after kam comes krodh. Because if desire is fulfilled, we're frustrated. Krodh means anger. That can also mean the anger. We think of anger as being expressed by punching or shouting, but that inner frustration, that's also a manifestation of anger. So that comes about when our desire is fulfilled. We have an aim and we want to fulfill it, and either we don't fulfill it and we're frustrated, or we do fulfill it and it doesn't give us the satisfaction that we thought, and still we're, so we become frustrated. Then we desire something else. And this goes on. Desire, another desire, another desire. We're never satisfied. We think, let me get this object. We get it and we find it doesn't give us the happiness that we wanted. Or we fulfill a goal, but we didn't count on we think that, well, I'll get this job, that'll be great. But then you get the job and then you find there are so many other factors which you didn't count on, that it may be so many things. So many people are anxious to go to Dubai, and then they think, well, that's a lot of money, but then the house rents are so much nowadays in Dubai, you just spend it on house rent. So then you can go and live in Sharjah, and then the house rents are much less there, but then you have to spend 1.5 hours up and 1.5 hours down traveling every day. So then you're completely exhausted. So there always, that's the nature of this world, there's no ideal situation. But we're always trying to adjust everything to get some ideal situation. So, the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna teaches us that there is no ideal situation in this world, and to expect that or to desire that is ignorance. To chase after material desires, that does not bring happiness. That brings distress. Yehi sangsparshaja bhoga dukha yone evate adyantavanta kuntaya nateshu ramate buddhaha. Those who are buddha, those who are intelligent, they see that material desire means, what is that? It's the interaction of the senses with their object. We see something, we desire it. We want to see nice things, hear nice things, touch. All the senses have their objects. And one who desires this, they think it will bring happiness. But Lord Krishna says that no, it's the cause of distress. So the whole materialistic civilization is working on this principle that let us produce more goods for our sense enjoyment. This will bring happiness to human society. This whole industrial, technological, mega mess has come about with the idea that we shall manipulate material nature in such a way we will produce so many things, and then we will be better, and then we will be happier. And so many more gadgets are coming out, just like this cell phone. Inevitably, someone's cell phone went off and he had to run off. Someone was just telling me that someone had written a letter to the Hindu in Chennai and said that someone stole my cell phone and I couldn't recover it, and I went to the temple and I was praying to the Lord to try and get it back. And after a month of not having, I didn't get another one. I came after a month and I prayed to the Lord, please bless the person who stole it. My life is so much more peaceful nowadays. Often people ask me, Swamiji, how can you get peace? And the first thing is throw away your cell phone. Because it's all these things we get for convenience, but then the convenience turns into harassment. Email is the same. You get email, it's very convenient. And then all of a sudden you find you're getting 30 letters a day. And there's no time. And all junk mail, you have to look through. Is there actually any mail for me? No, it's another junk mail, another junk mail, another junk. Someone else promising something for nothing. So, all the cars, you see, it's convenient that you can go from one place to another very quickly. But then you get so many cars, and that's, well, we don't really have an excuse for being late, but, you know, it's the perennial traffic jam. So many times you can be in a big city, you want to, how we have to go somewhere 2 kilometers. How should we go? What's the quickest way to go? Walking. Really? Because it's 24-hour gridlock. The cities are blocked up. You can go in the subway, or helicopters are banned now, even if you could afford one. They don't allow in the cities because for security reasons. So that's the quickest way to go. In many big cities, is by walking. Because the car, which became a convenience, has now become an inconvenience, and so many side effects. So, anyway, it's all predicted by Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita that whatever we try to design in this world to make life better doesn't make it better, because it's based on a misconception that we can be happy simply by manipulating the objects of this material world. Now, another cause for stress, we can say, well, why don't we go back to, throw out all the cell phones and the cars, and then we'll go and live in mud houses. It's actually not such a bad idea. Guess what the latest thing is in America? Building technology, mud houses. They're building apartment blocks out of, not exactly mud, but the clay mixed with lime, and it's all like natural ingredients, and it's much better for health than cement and all these things. So, should we go back to a primitive lifestyle? Well, even if we did, of course, that way of life is not necessarily primitive. That's another misconception. The rishis in India, they were living very simply, but their spiritual consciousness was very high. So although their material conveniences were not very developed, actually they didn't even want that. They deliberately accepted tapasya for the sake of developing their consciousness. That the more we get involved with all material things, then the less time and proclivity we have for developing our spiritual consciousness. I would say even then, all right, let's all go to the village and live very simply. But even then, there's going to be some stress. Because in the back of everyone's mind is the fear of death. That's there for everyone. So the material situation is it's inescapably difficult. Therefore, the best mantras or the best teachers of mantras are not those who simply give us some cure that you get free from stress. How you can get, just lower your stress levels enough so that you can go on with your work. But rather we have to have a better goal. Now we're not recommending that you close down this institution here. It's in the manner of many modern companies. They try to set it up in such a way that on one hand they're giving you stress to make or to induce you to work to get the results for which it is set up, and at the same time there's some human element, just like there's some nice gardens here, so that you can relax. That human element is there. And it may be in so many other ways also. But what we are suggesting is that it can only be a suggestion, of course, because it's up to you to use your intelligence and your discrimination to accept it and reject it. That is in Vedic psychology, these sankalpa vikalpa, the two functions of the mind, acceptance and rejection. Everything we see, touch, taste, smell, feel, or hear about, we process it. Is it something that I want or something that I don't want? What's my reaction to this? We accept and reject. So this proposal, you can either accept it or reject it. We are simply making a proposal. It's up to you. It's something you can adopt in your individual life. You may have already done so to some extent. That human life is not meant simply for material development, making the body comfortable, earning money. But over and above this, there is a much more important principle that we have to do something for maintaining the body, as Lord Krishna himself states in Bhagavad Gita. Sharira yatrapi chate na prasiddhyat akarmanaha. He says that everyone has to do some work, at least for maintenance of the body. So Lord Krishna doesn't say stop work. Arjuna wanted to stop what he was doing, but Krishna said, no, you have to do it, even though it's not very nice. His duty was to fight. He didn't want to, but Krishna said, you have to. Mamanusmara yudhyacha. Think of me and fight. That's the difference between Arjuna's fighting and that of others. So human life is meant for asking the really important questions. Not simply ahara nidra bhaya maitunam cha. Eating, sleeping, mating and defending. Samanyam etat pashubhya naranam. Human beings and animals eat, sleep, fight, fear, and reproduce. So the difference between a human and an animal, here we have, what's the difference between a human and an animal? Dharmo hitesham adhiko vishesham. Dharma is the adhik visheshta, the extra specialty of human life. So, animal propensities, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, plus dharma equals human being. So, A plus B equals C, therefore C minus B equals A. I'm sure you all can understand this. human being minus dharma, dharmena hina pashubhyanaranam. Human being minus dharma is an animal in human form. The body is there of a human, but the consciousness is that of an animal. Therefore, real human life is not characterized by having two legs. That can be dvipadda pashu. But human life is characterized by atato brahma jignasa. That now, in human life, there is the possibility for brahma jignasa. Inquiry into the ultimate truth. Now, if one does that, then everything else that one does is seen in a different perspective. An enlightened karma yogi, he's doing his work, but he's also a yogi. Now, it's not just, some people say, well, I'm a karma yogi. It's not just by karma that one becomes a karma yogi. Because the donkey is also working. The donkey is not a karma yogi. It's not just, or even it's not just by reciting some Gita shlokas in the morning that one becomes a karma yogi. Or if one's working the night shift, one wakes up at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You could also recite your Gita shlokas. But yoga, one should know what is the meaning of this. Yoga means yukti, linking with what? Linking again, atato brahma jignasa, with the supreme, brahma. So one should know what is the supreme, what is our relationship with the supreme, what are we doing here in this world? Real intelligence is not even necessarily measured in intelligence quotient. One may be a member of Mensa, and from the perspective of spiritual intelligence, still be a complete fool. One can have material intelligence, but if one doesn't ask the really important questions about life, then one remains foolish. If one uses one's intelligence simply to try to further one's position in a hopeless situation, then that's not intelligent. Just like, for instance, if you're you're sitting in a car which is driving very fast and it's going right towards a brick wall. So as you're driving towards the brick wall, you're adjusting the seat so it's very comfortable and fiddling with the radio to try to find some station, which one I like to listen to. Is that very intelligent? Of course not. You should see that I have to avoid it. Let's change the course, otherwise we're going to smash up. So the same thing, we're all heading towards death, and we're trying to make our situation very comfortable. This is not very intelligent. There's no harm if we're going on a long journey, there's no harm in adjusting the seat, but we should see where we're going to. Lack of inquiry into the purpose of life leads us to think that we don't really think about it, but we just generally think, well, we're living here now and what we're doing is, that's it. And after death, well, maybe we'll see later. Or we try to convince ourselves that there's nothing after death. This is the philosophy of an ostrich. He's got his head in the sand, he doesn't know, he doesn't see, that's it. But we should see that there are many intelligent, and if we are to accept that there is any such thing as spiritual realization, many people say, well, there's just no such thing. Without any investigation, they just say, well, it's just meaningless. We don't know, we don't accept there's any such thing. That's a sign of, again, poor intelligence to write off that there's no such thing as spiritual life. There's no such thing. Just to say, no investigation, just, I'm not interested, therefore it doesn't exist. This is, again, the foolishness of an ostrich, or like a young child. I remember my younger sister, when she was maybe 4 years old, she had what she thought was an amusing game. She would close her eyes and say, "You can't see me." So it's like that. I don't believe there's any such thing as spiritual life, but that's it. I don't see it, therefore it doesn't exist. This is foolishness. So if we, at least theoretically, we can accept that there may be, actually it's most reasonable to accept that there are many things beyond our immediate range of understanding. If we think that the whole of existence is within that which we can perceive and immediately analyze, as is the empiric proposition, then that immediately limits us, because almost certainly there are so many areas of reality that we don't have direct access to. Why should we think that everything that is to be seen is within the light range that our eyes can handle? Or that there may be different kinds of perception, that we touch, taste, smell, feel, hear, and think about it all, but there may be other kinds of perception which are completely different. So the first proposition of empiricism or rationalism, that we only accept that which we can perceive, that's empiricism. Well, that's irrational. Why should it be that all of reality is within the scope of perception of our senses and the scope of understanding of our highly limited intelligence? So if we are to accept that there is more to existence than simply working hard, getting money, eating something, passing it out the next day, and in this way going on until we drop dead, then that should be looked into. And actually all knowledge that we require for spiritual uplift is there in concise form in Bhagavad Gita. First of all, understanding that, as Lord Krishna says, Bahuni mevyatitani janmani tavacharjuna, we are all taking many, many births. This life is not all in all. But what we do in this life affects our future. It's not that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. It's only true on the energetic or the physical or the platform of energy. But there are other energies. There's karmic energy also. So that affects. We can't think that we can perform sinful activities and there won't be a result. Certainly there will be. So we should know what is activity that will be ultimately beneficial for us, and that which will not. It is required to know that. Otherwise, we will do things which we think are beneficial for us, but ultimately will not be. Just like in India now, it's being promoted so much. Not just now, but for so many years. Eat meat, become strong, become healthy. Well, it's debatable, first of all, whether it is more healthy, because we find in the Western countries where there have been meat eaters for generations, and actually this idea of eating lots of meat only came up after the Second World War, because previous to that there wasn't intensive farming. There wasn't a refrigeration and mass transportation which made it possible for people to eat meat on a daily basis. Even in the Western countries, they didn't used to eat meat every day, only the very richest people. But now they're discovering, everyone knows that the vegetarian diet is better for health. But it was promoted from the 1950s that eating meat will make you more healthy. Eating lots of meat, more protein, and you get more strong. So now in India, they're still promoting that. Whereas in the Western countries, they found out that no, that's not true. That's bad for health. The body can only process a certain amount of protein, and excess protein, like excess anything, is harmful for the body, not beneficial. So people are thinking, well, let us eat more meat, and that will be more healthy. But that has a reaction. We're caught up in the reaction of killing animals, which is, in most circumstances, in the modern circumstances, the slaughter of animals in the butcher's shop is a sinful activity. So we get a result for that. But we don't know. We just take everything on a very superficial level. That, well, we heard it's good for health. So let's eat. Never mind about all these old superstitions. But the Vedic knowledge is not superstition. Ved means vidya, the very meaning of the word. Vid, to know. So that knowledge is holistic knowledge. It's not simply some knowledge which gives us some immediate apparent benefit, but it benefits us in a complete way. As I was saying, Ayurveda is there also. It's knowledge for the body is there. Knowledge for economic development is there. Knowledge of mathematics is there. Still, one trained in Vedic mathematics can solve. You give two 20-digit numbers, and someone who knows Vedic mathematics, they can solve it quicker than the computer, because you have to enter it in the computer, and you can't enter it as quickly as they can give you the answer. I don't know how it works, but it does. So Vedic mathematics is actually so much science is there in the Vedic knowledge. We have all the terms are there for sine, cosine, all the different mathematical terms. I don't know the Sanskrit term. Trikona, triangle. Then we have the word paramanu, which means atom. These are ancient Sanskrit words. So it's not that the ancient Vedic culture was devoid of knowledge of this world, and they studied this world. We have names for the planets. They were studied. And actually the knowledge of astronomy was essential in Vedic life, because for astrological predictions, you have to know the position of the planets. The Tithi, how it interacts with the day, what is astrology in Vedic culture was mainly used, or its daily usage was for calculating the times for performing pujas and yajnas and all these things, because it all has an effect. It's all very interlinked in the complex ways. So people say, well, astrology is all such rubbish and this and that. But just consider, to do astrology, one has to have sophisticated knowledge of astronomy. So the planets are described there. Interestingly, among the planets, there's no Pluto. They thought they discovered. Now they undiscovered it again. But it's not there, and it's not mentioned as a planet in the Vedic understanding. So all knowledge is there of how to live in this world, sophisticated knowledge, but the knowledge is ultimately to come out of this world. That we don't belong here. This world is dukhalayam, ashashvatam. This is the place of misery where everything is temporary. So that the most intelligent person, the, function of intelligence is, first of all, to see what is for our benefit, what is actually for our benefit. One who is not intelligent and not trained doesn't know how to act for their benefit. A child doesn't know. A child may want to touch the fire. They don't know. They're not trained. But when they become experienced and intelligent, they know, no, don't touch fire. It looks interesting. But an intelligent person, no, don't. Or if you see some open wire attached to the socket, then it looks quite harmless. But you know, that's dangerous. If you touch, you're going to get a shock. So an experienced person, they know how to act in a way, what is beneficial for them, what is not. They don't act in a way simply because it seems appealing to the senses. You may think, well, there's some nice food, so let me eat more and more and more and more. But an intelligent person knows that, no, wait a minute, I'm going to get indigestion, I'm going to get sick. So they control the senses. So ultimate intelligence means to see what is for our ultimate benefit. And the ultimate benefit cannot be simply that for the body, because the body is temporary. So what is the ultimate benefit? That is the benefit of that who is the real me. I am the soul. I am eternal soul. What is our spiritual benefit? Our spiritual benefit is to get free from identifying with the body. That frees us from birth and death, repeated birth and death. So this may not seem to have any practical application to your life whatsoever, but it does. Even to be free from stress of your workplace, if one understands that I have to work, yes, I have to work, I've accepted this, I'm accepting the payment, therefore it's my responsibility to discharge what I'm being paid for to the best of my ability. But at the same time, understand that this is not the ultimate goal. That beyond this, I have a higher goal. That definitely in work and in life, there are so many ups and downs, and especially in the modern age, there are more downs than ups. There's so many difficulties. But one can be detached from all of this by understanding that all this is temporary and I have a higher goal. That higher goal is to re-establish my eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. That is bhakti yoga. So in bhakti yoga, the mantra meditation, we're talking about meditation. So I was talking about the mantras which give us knowledge, discussing some of the knowledge, some of the principles of spiritual knowledge. Spiritual knowledge begins with janma mrityu jaravyadhi dukkha doshanu darshanam, perceiving the misery of repeated birth, death, old age and disease. That is the beginning of spiritual knowledge. That is the negative principle. Then we come to the positive principle, that beyond the misery of material life is the bliss of understanding one's, not just understanding, but entering into and experiencing one's eternal relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the most important process of bhakti yoga, the mantra which acts, the best mantra for acting on one's mind and purifying it from kam, krodh, lobh, moha, mada, matsarya, which automatically balances the mind. Even there are psychological studies have been made to ratify this. But the best mantra is the Hare Krishna mantra, which links us with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, links us in our eternal attitude of bhakti, of service to Him. So there's much, much more to be said about this than can be said in a few seconds, few minutes. I've spoken in a very basic way. I'm sure many of you are aware of many of the principles I've spoken of. Nevertheless, it's good to hear them again and again, because by the influence of Maya, we tend to get caught up in the moment that we are living in. But seeing beyond the momentary, seeing our situation within the eternal, and what is our eternal position beyond Secunderabad 2006, beyond India, beyond this planet, beyond this universe, we have our eternal situation at the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. So understanding this, that everything here is temporary, I don't belong here, that gives us the detachment to go on in this world in a way that we can become elevated to the spiritual world. It doesn't mean, it may mean, but probably not for all of you, abandonment of one's material situation. But it means living in that situation with one's ultimate goal of life on that situation which is beyond birth and death. So, Hare Krishna. Thank you for so patiently listening. And if there are any questions or comments, we could take that now. Do we have another practice? One practice? Okay. But let's see if there are any questions first. Practical chanting. You can do that also. Any questions, comments, protests? Do we have a cordless mic? No. All right, please say and I'll repeat it. The definition of
desire.
Well, it's a dictionary word. It doesn't require a very it doesn't require a specific spiritual definition. Desire is difficult to define it without using a synonym. It means that in relationship with an object or goal, to have the motivation to possess it or attain it. Spiritual desire, yes, there is spiritual desire. We don't say stop all desire, that is not possible. But spiritual desire means the desire to attain that which is ultimately beneficial for us. And as we are ultimately spiritual beings, it means to attain our spiritual situation. So we all have desire. I came here today to fulfill the desire of Sridhar that I come here, and to fulfill my desire is to act in a manner that will be pleasing to my Guru Maharaj. So his desire is that I try to spread what he has given to others, as he did so to fulfill the desire of his Guru Maharaj. So everything acts on desire. The desire to please Krishna is a pure desire. That pure desire is awakened by chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Hare Krishna. Yeah, please.
Why should we desire to come out of the cycle of birth and death? Why is it necessary
to come out of birth and death? Well, we're all happiness seeking, isn't it? Everyone desires happiness. That's the nature of a living being, not only human being. Every living being desires happiness. But kim sukham martya dhaminam, where is the happiness in a place where there's repeated death? The nature of this world is that there is repeated birth and death. So that brings distress, that is by its nature distressful. So one should desire to go to a situation where there is unlimited and unrestricted happiness, that is in the spiritual world, not here. It just makes sense. It's just like, you know, if someone wants to beat you with sticks, you don't have to do a psychological analysis to try to understand why you should not want to be in that situation. So we are being beaten by repeated birth and death. You conquer the fear of death, but still it's suffering. You can't say it's not suffering. Birth, death, old age and disease is suffering. This last time I was here in the Twin Cities, the chikungunya was going around. Did any of you get that?
I got it.
You got it. Many got it. So, was it fun? Suffering, yeah.
Even now, joint pain.
Still you have joint pain. So we can't say that it's not suffering. It's definitely suffering.
No, we tend to suffer only when we decide to suffer.
Well, you can say like that, but you know, next time you get chikungunya, you can see if it's more desirable than not having it. Actually, what you're saying is right, because we say these things and Krishna says these things, but these are actually symptoms of a deeper suffering. The birth, death, old age and disease of this material world, that is symptomatic of the deeper suffering of the Atma whose natural position is with Krishna. That not being in a situation of loving Krishna, that is in itself suffering for the jiva. And the symptoms of that are birth, death, old age, disease and everything else. Because the dharma for the jiva is that the jiva is intimately connected with Krishna. On the material platform, we see a child is distressed when separated from his mother. So that is a reflection of the intimate loving relationship that every is the dharma of the jiva, to be connected with Krishna. So lacking that, we are suffering. We are not in our natural position. It is not, we can say we can get free from birth and death, but it's not a natural position to be in. It's unnatural. So it's just like a fish. If you take a fish out of water, then you can give the, we can make a bank account for the fish with a crore of rupees and give the fish food. But whatever you do for the fish, the latest, most popular fish hit songs, whatever it may be. But the fish can never be happy. The fish can never be content if it's not in the water. So, that's again, it's a mundane. Well, we're not aware, but at the same time, we can perceive that there's something basically wrong here. You're working in this company. You like working in this company? How much do you like working? If they didn't pay you, would you still come? You would. If you could choose anything to do in your life, what you would choose to do is come and work in this company. Is it? We're all bound to do things that we don't want to do. I'm not speaking against the company, but we go on holidays because the working is something which is, it's a necessity. It's not what we'd, well, maybe we would choose. Like Bill Gates is retiring, but he's not retiring from work altogether, but he's working in a different way. He wants to do philanthropy. And actually it's a fact that often people, after they retire, they feel empty because they want to do some work. But, we all desire something else, just like you might like to work for this company, but maybe you'd like to be a notch higher than you are now. So, there are situations are forced upon us. We get a toothache. We don't choose to have a toothache. And it's not fun. But we can't avoid it. So, again, it comes down to the same position. This material world is not, it's not an ultimately desirable situation. We should see that. And we can learn of that ultimately desirable situation from those who are in contact with that, those whose consciousness is not merely in this world, but whose consciousness is linked with the spiritual world. And we can see manifest in their behavior that persons who are on the spiritual platform, they do have a realization which is higher. It's not just some bluff. There is a lot of bluff in the name of spiritual life, and most of it is bluff, but that doesn't mean that it's all bluff. So one's faith is awakened by, first of all, observing the difficulties of material life and observing persons who have, to a greater or lesser extent, transcended that. And then you can chant Hare Krishna. That's what we're going to do now. And what happens is kartakshavagamang dharmyam susukam kartamavyayam. By engaging in bhakti yoga, pratyaksh, we get direct perception. One can begin to experience immediately the dharma of the jiva. When we say dharma here, we're not talking about Hindu religion or Muslim religion, but dharma means the intrinsic nature. We can begin to experience What is our relationship with Krishna? Of course, it takes time to develop, but we can immediately begin to experience that. If we weren't experiencing anything, then what is that experience? Susukam kartamavya. It's an experience of susuka, great happiness. So often people ask me that, well, how long have you been doing this mantra meditation? And I tell them, more than 30 years, and they say, well, are you happy? So then I throw the question back at them, well, what do you think? If I wasn't happy, why should I do it? If we tell you some of the rules, you might think, I'd better get out of here quick. Because we rise daily by 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock latest. And no meat, no fish, no eggs, no gambling, no coffee, no tea, no illicit sex, which means sex is allowed for within marriage, for procreation, not recreation. So there are many rules to follow, and you may think, well, that's too much. But then you may think, well, why are you following them? Because we're getting something. We're getting something which makes it worth our following, and actually we don't even like to perform these various illicit activities because there is a higher taste. We're getting something better. So you can consider that either all the great spiritual teachers of the world were cheaters or fools in great illusion, or they had something. And they communicated, they came and they communicated, and many people expressed that they are receiving something from that. So there might just be something there. We should consider it at least as a reasonable proposition that the many lakhs of people in the world who have had genuine spiritual experiences, I'm not talking about fanatical or dogmatic or sentimental religion, we're talking about genuine spiritual experience, that there's, it would seem from the volume of people who have spoken about this through the ages, that there is something real there, which is worthwhile our investigating. We find that if we see the spiritual philosophy of ancient India, it's not something for fools. It's the intricacies of it are so complex that most people nowadays, they just can't even begin to understand it. Now, intelligent people of India are using their intelligence in doing things like what you're doing. But previously, it was a normal thing that pundits would discuss among themselves, and not just as a recreation, but they were very serious about tattvamasi, what is the import of this, or vivartavad versus parinamvad, and they were very serious about this. Nowadays, even to begin to understand what is vivartavad vis-a-vis parinamvad, shakti parinamvad, people can't even begin to grasp it because it's very intricate. It's not subject matter for simply some fools. It requires a deep level of intelligence to understand. That's why we're not very happy with all these pop gurus who just, they have a little beard and they say a few slogans and they charge you a bunch of money for going to their courses. They don't really teach you anything. They're just cheating people, and people, so many people are anxious to be cheated. But the real spiritual culture of India is something very deep. It's not some cheap thing. The misrepresentation is worse than the neglect. So please don't be cheated by these cheap so-called gurus who are Guruvo Bahavo Santi Shishya Vitapaharaka, as is stated in Shastra. There are many gurus who are very expert in taking away their disciples' money. But Durlabha Sadguru Devi Shishya Santapaharaka. But very rare is that guru who can take away the santa, the distress, the stress and the distress of the disciple. So please consider all these things. We have books here, Bhagavad Gita as it is, which it's not simply some sentiment or some, it requires you to apply your God-given intelligence to understand it. Of course, it's not only by intelligence that it can be understood, by Bhagavad Kripa also. First December is not Gita Jayanti, that's a modern term. Jayanti actually means the appearance day of Lord Krishna. It's the anniversary of the day on which Lord Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita. So, actually, Bhagavad Gita is for 365 days a year. But some sentiment is there. Gita Jayanti, they say. 1st of December this year. So it's a good day to start reading the Bhagavad Gita, as it is. Every day is a good day to start. But you could also start on the day that